Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. It's been a week of highs and lows, foreign and domestic. The Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in favor of Al Franken, and the Democrats' 60th senator thanked his supporters.
Thank you to the people of Minnesota for your patience, for your thoughts and prayers, and for giving me the opportunity to work for you in Washington.
U.S. Marines pushed into southern Afghanistan. Their commanders say the mission is to protect and serve Afghans.
International Security Assistance Forces and U.S. Marines in particular are here to support them, for them to build their own way of life. So we're here for as long as it takes.
And a milestone in Iraq as U.S. combat troops pulled out of urban areas. Iraqis celebrated. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? The bleak new unemployment numbers? How about the Democrats' 60-seat Senate majority? The surge in Afghanistan? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Jibby Martinez, political columnist and contributor to Politico. Jibby, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Joining me from Chicago, Steve Chapman, columnist and editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune. Steve, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Jane.
And with us, as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic. Jack, welcome.
Hello, Jane, Jibby, and Steve.
So let's begin with the new unemployment numbers out. Job losses continue. They are broad and deep across manufacturing, construction, professional services. The unemployment rate has risen to 9.5%, its highest level in 25 years. Last week, another 614,000 people applied for unemployment insurance benefits. Steve Chapman, I'll turn to you first. What do you make of the numbers?
Well, I don't make a whole lot of them. We all know we're in a very serious recession, and I doubt that the unemployment rate is done rising. It's probably going to go up a little more, but it's worth keeping in mind that unemployment is generally a lagging indicator, and there are some signs that the economy has bottomed out and is starting to pick up a little bit. And I think if you fixate on the unemployment number, things look very grim. But I think the other signs are that maybe things are about to turn around or have already turned around.
Jibby, I'm reading many economists who say it's likely that the jobless rate will hit double digits later this year. Where do you stand on this? Do you agree with Steve, a lagging indicator?
Well, I do think that even the president is afraid to say where they're going to go, but he has already predicted it would be in double digits before we see it turning around. What I thought was kind of interesting from some of the reports yesterday is that the spending of consumers seems to have settled into, I guess you could call it, complacency. They're spending less, and they've learned the habit of spending less because of the fears of the economy. So if we're going to, we have to drive the economy by spending more. You can't spend more if you don't have a job. And, that whole vicious cycle mm-hmm. that we're in mm-hmm. deeply. So I do think that the Republicans are hitting a good point when they say, what happened to the stimulus? Why aren't we seeing the jobs yet that they promised we would see? That's what people remember. They remember all of the money being set aside for the stimulus. And just looking at it in its very basic form, people see, jobs are still not there. High unemployment is going up. And where are the jobs? And I think that people are worried.
Jack Beattie, that's what the Republicans say. This is proof that President Obama's stimulus plan is failing. It's not living up to its promises.
Well, only 10% of the plan has thus far been implemented. We're only feeling the effects of that. The full plan doesn't really start to work until next year. And we really have a situation where, as the economist Brad DeLong points out today, U.S. fiscal policy as a whole, states and federal government, is probably contractionary. Yeah, we've had a fiscal stimulus from the federal government, but every state government is cutting back severely to a tune, I think, aggregately of something like $160 billion this year. And that is just nothing but a drag on the economy. And part of the stimulus is actually preventing that from being worse. I mean, 19% of Nevada's budget now is from the stimulus. 26% of the shortfall in Rhode Island's is being made up by the stimulus. 22% of Florida's. So that stimulus is hidden in it's actually making things a little less bad in the states. But as a net proposition, we probably don't have a stimulus.
In an interview this week with the Associated Press, President Obama was asked about the state of the economy. Here he is.
We are deeply concerned about the employment rate. It's one of the things that I am most focused on when I think about long-term economic policy. We have successfully stabilized the financial markets, and that's important because that was a huge drag that helped precipitate the crisis. We've started to see some stabilization on housing, but what we're still seeing is too many jobs lost, too many families who are worried about whether they're going to be next.
Steve Chapman, how do you see the White House efforts, President Obama's efforts to stem the job losses? Sufficient?
Well, I think the it's unfair. It's a little unfair for Republicans to say this proves the stimulus didn't work because, as Jack pointed out, very little of the money has been spent yet, and most of the money is not going to, and we're talking direct federal outlays, is not going to be spent until next year. But I think that points up another problem with the whole approach, which is that any sort of fiscal stimulus takes a long time to work its way into the economy. And this is a recession that started in December of 2007, so it's already a year and a half old. And by the time most of this money gets spent, it's probably going to be history. And it's not clear that it's going to do much good even when it takes place.
Jimmy Martinez, we hear in that clip President Obama saying we've successfully stabilized financial markets, housing markets. Take stock here overall how the Obama administration is handling generally this economic crisis.
I think that the public sees that they're genuinely concerned and trying to do something about it. I think, though, that there is some impatience. I agree with the comments that it is unfair for the Republicans to be attacking them at this time. I mean, the president said it took us years to get into this mess. It's going to take us a while longer to get out of it. That is true. But, you know, politics isn't fair. And John Boehner, the House leader, Republican leader, issued a statement yesterday saying, you know, the Americans were promised that the stimulus would keep unemployment rate from going above 8%. So the Republicans are going to constantly remind the people out there, you're not feeling better yet. And the administration is trying to say, yes, but we inherited this mess, without keeping the responsibility on the Bush administration. They know that they don't have to do the work themselves. But they are trying to remind people, look, you know, we didn't create this mess.
Jack, take stock for us, your perspective, how the Obama administration is handling overall the economic crisis.
Well, I think they dug themselves in put themselves in trouble by predicting unemployment wouldn't go above 8%, and their figures for growth right from the start were very rosy. I don't know why they did that, frankly. It creates a credibility crisis. But I think the public understands that, you know, there isn't a magic wand by which the executive can cure the economy. These are long-term problems. And it's strange. I mean, for the first time in a long time, Americans are doing the right thing in terms of saving. Our savings rate is going up. But, of course, that's just the wrong thing macroeconomically. We need to spend, not save. The Harris poll this week came out with a poll of consumer practices, and something like half of Americans now are taking brown bag lunches. They're not buying them. 36% are postponing haircuts. 29% canceled magazine subscriptions. Alas, and Steve, 15% of cat canceled newspaper subscriptions. So
okay,
the,
now things are getting serious.
Now things are really getting serious out there. So people are saving. They're cutting back just when than they need for the sake of the economy to be spending. And that's a cycle that only the government can break by stimulating the economy more. And there's more and more talk that we may need a second stimulus.
Let's squeeze a call in very quickly here before the break. Sue is on the line. She's in Duxbury, Massachusetts. Sue, welcome to On Point.
Hi. Hi. I just wondered what you all were thinking about the Paul Krugman article today that said that we need more of a stimulus, that it was too weak to begin with, and we need a bigger one to prevent what happened in 1937. And how is Obama going to do that with a Congress that really doesn't want to do anything more?
Sue, thanks. Steve Chapman, what about Paul Krugman's article today?
I have trouble following Paul Krugman because he goes from back and forth from being pessimistic to optimistic. A couple of weeks ago, he said that he would not be surprised if the recovery began this summer. So it's a little hard for me to figure out why he thinks if that's true, we need another stimulus.
Jibby Martinez, more of a stimulus package?
There was some talk about it some time ago, but I really don't think that the leadership has sensed that the Congress is in a hurry to do that. They have so many other things going on. And I think that one of the things that the president is trying to do with the health care debate is to say if we can, you know, fix health care, that will help, you know, people with the rising cost of their medical care and kind of, you know, help people on the economic front in that way. But I don't think there's a stomach for it in Congress to do any more stimulus.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news. We're joined this hour by Steve Chapman of the Chicago Tribune, Jibby Martinez of Politico, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Well, after months of litigation, the Minnesota Supreme Court decided this week that Al Franken got the most votes for the state's highly contested Senate seat. That decision adds another Democrat to the U.S. Senate, but Franken said in a press conference on Tuesday he doesn't see things that way.
I know there's been a lot of talk about the fact that when I'm sworn in, I'll be the 60th member of the Democratic caucus, but that's not how I see it. The way I see it, I'm not going to Washington to be the 60th Democratic senator. I'm going to Washington to be the second senator from the state of Minnesota, and that's how I'm going to do this job.
Jibby Martinez, what's your view on how this will affect the Senate? Does this give Democrats new mathematical might?
I don't think so on some of the key issues, actually. Yes, technically he is a 60th vote, but he's right to say that he's not going to be the 60th vote all the time because there are, in fact, more moderate to conservative senators than he on the Democratic side who will not vote with the Democratic caucus. Where there comes a loyalty vote on a cloture vote, for example, to close debate or something, the majority leader will impose loyalty. And in that sense, yes, there could be 60 votes gathered for a particular issue. But look at what's ahead real quickly. We've got the health care debate. We have the energy bill. There's talk about doing immigration this fall or early next spring, next winter. So there is so much going on in the plate that shows conservative Democrats breaking away from the party, that Al Franken's vote won't necessarily be decisive.
Steve Chapman, do you agree this is not necessarily a magical 60 vote?
Yeah, on most issues, I don't think it is. And you've got two senators, Kennedy and Byrd, whose health has been a little shaky lately, who can't necessarily be counted on to be there. I think if it's going to make a big difference, it's on judicial nominations, because that's where you really, if Republicans want to fight a particular court nomination, and this is probably not the Supreme Court, but the lower courts, then there are times when the Democrats will be able to force a vote on a nomination when the Republicans would rather filibuster.
Jack Beatty, you say this 60th senator scenario puts a lot of pressure on President Obama himself.
Well, I think it does psychologically. I think his supporters, his base supporters, now, you know, they do take 60 as the magic number. We now know that that's the new 50 in the Senate. And I think that it creates expectations that, as Jibby and Steve pointed out, the Senate, the composition of the Senate may not fulfill. But I think there's no question that it does make people think, well, Mr. President, stand and deliver. Now you have the votes.
Speaking of the Senate, Democratic leaders of the Senate Health Committee this week unveiled a revised plan to provide health coverage to nearly all Americans. This is a plan that would require most employers to offer benefits to their workers or pay fees to the government to do so. And it would create a public competitor to insurance companies. What do you make of this new Senate proposal, Steve Chapman?
Well, I think the public option is going to be a very difficult thing to get through. I think there's a general sense that if you have the government as a competitor, it's not going to be a fair competitor. It's going to be have access to the Treasury in a way that private companies don't, or it's going to have a federal guarantee in the way that companies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac did, and that it's going to be able to use that position to the disadvantage of private competitors. If you want to look at Medicare as an example of a government option, that's a program that's run up, that's costs have gone up, at a very rapid rate, and it's looking at running out of money, and I think that's an indication that I think the Congress is going to have to take a long look before they decide to do that. Mm.
More broadly speaking here on health care, Republicans remain quite critical of President Obama's proposed health care plans. And earlier this week, House Republican Conference Chair Mike Pence of Indiana criticized this so-called public option we've talking about that's now being considered.
Most Americans understand that if the federal option became available to all Americans, that millions of Americans would lose the health insurance that they have right now, not because the government would mandate that they would lose it, but because millions of employers, seeing an available public option, would simply inform their employees, we're no longer incurring the expense of offering health insurance. You can call the government to get your health insurance.
And speaking at a town hall meeting this week, President Obama pushed back against this resistance to his plan from corporate health care interests.
I do think we should have a public plan to compete with the private plans. But, these private insurance companies, they're always telling me what a great deal that they give to the American consumer. If it's such a great deal, why are they worried about competing against the public plan? Especially when they say government can't do anything.
Jibby Martinez, how do you see Democrats' latest plan for health care reform?
Well, the big reason why they're tweaking with the plan still is because the original plan was so expensive, right, and didn't seem to have enough coverage for the uninsured. It was like over $1 trillion estimate, and it was only going to cover about 16 million of the uninsured, and the total uninsured is like 54 million. Mm-hmm. So the numbers of people who would be covered additionally was not good enough. Under the new plan that they unveiled, they were trying to bring down the cost, and they did somewhat. But it still only brings up the coverage to about 21 million out of 54 million. So, as long as the cost is really high and the number of people covered is relatively low, they're going to have trouble getting support for this, not just in the public, but in Congress. I mean, there are members of, from conservative states and districts that understand there's a need for a health care plan, but the math of this one doesn't work. Mm.
$1 trillion originally, now down to about $611 billion,
right,
as I'm reading here. Jack
right.
Beatty, Walmart this week made a big announcement, said it supports President Obama's push to require employers to offer health insurance to their workers.
Yeah, that's very significant. That's our largest private sector employer. And, of course, the two senators from Walmart, the two Arkansas senators who were doubtful on the plan, or at least aspects of it, that now brings them aboard, at least for the employer mandate. But, this question about competition and the public versus private plans, this week, Health Care for All, using data from the AMA, came out with a study on the market for insurance. And they found that something like 94% of our insurance markets are highly concentrated. That's according to the Justice Department. That is, there isn't much competition in them. I mean, Senator Shelby of Alabama said that a private public plan would destroy marketplace competition. Well, in Alabama, Blue Cross has 83% of the market. How could that be destroyed? It would just give Blue Cross necessary competition. The premiums, according to this study, in the insurance industry have been up 87% over the last 6 years. Profits at 10 of the largest insurance groups up 428% in a decade. This is not a competitive, you know, we have a sort of, in many markets, a kind of private sector monopoly to which the public sector plan might well actually introduce, you know, hitherto unknown competition.
Steve Chapman, a final point on this. Are you optimistic for President Obama's, what, fall deadline for some sort of health care bill?
I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's too big, it's too complicated, it's too expensive, and it's going to take longer than that to get it through, if he can get it through at all.
Let's move to the Supreme Court now. At the court this week, two of its most important decisions of the term handed down. There was the voting rights case out of Texas and the affirmative action case, hiring case out of New Haven, Connecticut, the firefighters case. Jibby Martinez, the implicit message from the court this week seemed to be that racial discrimination is not the significant problem it once was with these particular rulings.
You know, there were some civil rights groups who were very, very disappointed with the Supreme Court ruling in the New Haven case, because setting aside the politics about, you know, Sonia Sotomayor, which we can get to in a minute, you know, what they read that case as removing workplace protections for minorities and women that had been in place for decades. Now, this case stemmed out of, was an appeal from Sonia Sotomayor's court. And it was being watched because people thought it might determine thinking about her own appointment to the Supreme Court. And I think that what the Supreme Court showed in that regard is that, first of all, it was a 5-4 vote against her position. Her position did not prevail. At the same time, one of the dissenters was the justice who she's going to replace. And so what people read from that is, you know, she was not, you know, an outlier. She was part of the mainstream. She was standing up for judicial precedent. You know, these workplace protections for minorities have been in existence for decades, and that's what she was voting to uphold. So this is really a pretty mainstream position. And, you know, she's not going to be changing the makeup of the court when you look at a case like this.
Steve Chapman, what are the bigger takeaways from this term generally at the court? This is still a very divided Supreme Court.
Yeah, it is, and it's still Anthony Kennedy's court. I mean, if you want to know how any case is going to come out, basically all you need to know is how Anthony Kennedy is going to come out. He's going to be with the majority in most cases. In a lot of cases, in most of the 5-4 cases, he's the swing vote, and he's a guy who's not entirely comfortable with the conservative direction of the court, but he's not somebody that the liberals can count on most of the time either. So what he often does is sort of serve to dilute the force of the majority conservatives. I mean, they get their way, but not quite as in quite as pure a fashion as they would like.
Jack Beatty, with these particular rulings this week, do you see President Obama likely to be in conflict with the court on the questions, particularly of race?
Well, it could be. There does seem to be a slow, inexorable shift in this Roberts Court against many of the racial rulings, especially of the Warren Court. Chief Justice Roberts in the voting rights case seemed to be inviting a constitutional challenge there. There's this New Haven case. There was the Indiana case on voter ID. The Chief Justice, a man born to privilege, raised, best possible education, a brilliant man. He seems to have an animus against some of the you could almost say the weakest people in our society. He sides at almost every turn with corporations against plaintiffs, with the executive against people bringing cases there, and he has very little sympathy for civil rights. He does not believe that further judicial action is necessary to create a juster society, and I think that does put him in conflict, certainly with the politics of this administration. And you know, Barack Obama is the only president who actually voted against the man who swore him in. I mean, he voted against John Roberts just on these grounds. He said he's a brilliant man, but he favors the strong over the weak, and that's not what we need.
And Jane, if I could make one more point on the Judge Sotomayor's nomination and how this impacts that. You know, the criticism against her primarily is that she would use her life experience to influence her decisions on the court. And I think what we're seeing in this court that's just ended this session is, in fact, what we were just talking about. You know, Chief Justice Roberts certainly brings his background to his decisions. Clarence Thomas does, too. He has biases with regard to his own life experience. And the bottom line is, you know, the justices are human, and they're going to bring to the court what they know, what they've experienced. And in a way, I think that this ruling dilutes that criticism of Judge Sotomayor.
If I could jump in here, Jane.
Yes, Steve.
I think it's unfair to say that you've got all these John Roberts and the other white males on the court sort of ignoring and spurning the needs of ordinary people, the weak, minorities. I mean, in the case of the Voting Rights Act, you've got a law that's been in effect for 45 years at a time, and it was enacted at a time when blacks in the South really had to take their lives in their own hands to try to exercise the franchise. You've now got a country with a black president. You've got hundreds, thousands of black office holders in the old South, and yet in states where blacks have proven that they can turn out the vote, they can elect black office holders. You know, every entity that conducts elections in those states has to make the slightest change in its voting procedures. If you want to move a polling place from a church to a school, you've got to get federal clearance. And I think it's fair to say, you know, is that really a reasonable approach at this stage of our history? Mm.
I'd like to go to the phones for a couple of calls before our next break. Wayne is first. He's in Asheville, North Carolina. Well, Wayne, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. I agree with the Supreme Court decision on the firefighters. I think that any time a skill is required in any profession, whether it's brain surgery or fighting a fire, we want the best and the brightest to be selected. If it was a case of a white and a black and they were equal on their test scores, then perhaps you might sway towards the minority in this case.
But. Wayne, thank you. A person with the most skills should get the job. That's Wayne's perspective. Here's Matthew. He's in Nashville, Tennessee. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm actually a firefighter in a very in an area which is predominantly African-American. Mm-hmm. I'm actually one of two white firefighters in my district, as a matter of fact. And I just find it really kind of silly that we still continue to look at race and we want to promote, you know, especially in the New Haven case where they're wanting to promote minorities. And it seems really silly to me. One day I had a talk with my chief, and I asked him, I said, you know, why was I chosen out of, you know, all the other, you know, candidates? He said, well, we're looking for diversity. And in a way, that kind of broke my heart. You know, was I better than another black firefighter? Mm. Why was I chosen? And so it just seems, I don't know, it seems really silly that we're constantly, and we're still today, wanting to
talking about this issue. The clock's against me, Matthew, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but I got to go to break here. We're talking about the week in the news. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. More with our guests, our panel, and your calls after this break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. It's been a week of ongoing sagas in this country, from Hollywood to Wimbledon. Wall-to-wall Michael Jackson coverage. Janet Jackson had this to say.
To you, Michael is an icon. To us, Michael is family. And he will forever live in all of our hearts.
South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford had more candid words about his Argentine affair.
I don't want to blow up in my time in politics. I don't want to blow up future earning power. I don't want to blow up the kids' lives. I don't want to blow up the 20 years we've invested. But if I'm completely honest, there are still feelings in the way.
And the Williams sisters will meet in the Wimbledon final. Serena says it's something she and Venus love to do.
This is what we dreamed of when we were growing up in Compton 20-something years ago. So, you know, this is what we worked for and this is what we want.
What a game it will be. We're joined this hour by Steve Chapman of the Chicago Tribune, Jibby Martinez of Politico, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. This week, American forces pulled out of Iraqi cities in accordance with the deadline stated in their security agreement. On Tuesday, General Ray Odierno, a commander of American forces in Iraq, praised the efforts on both sides.
The Iraqi people should be very proud of the dedication, progress, and sacrifice of the Iraqi security forces and the government of Iraq. Their accomplishments in preparing for this day are commendable. The American people can also be very proud as well of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardsmen, as well as our civilians, who have worked so hard over the past years and tirelessly and sacrificed so much in helping the people of Iraq progress towards a peaceful and democratic society.
Jack Beatty, how do you see this milestone in Iraq in the arc of this conflict?
Well, it's been so long in coming, and it's hard to know how to know what it means for the Iraqis. You know, the issue of readiness, for example, of their forces. Last fall, a Pentagon study found that only 17 of the 174 combat battalions that they had were able to conduct counterinsurgency operations by themselves. 17 of 174. This business of training just seems to go on endlessly. And, of course, one reason, I think, is that we have been there. You know, motivation is more important than training. And these forces haven't been motivated, in large part, because they've known that Uncle Sam was right there ready to do the job for them. And maybe this will motivate some of them. On the other hand, when you see that the Sunni militia, the people who really made the surge possible by coming over, when you see that they're still waiting, 94,000 members of them are still waiting for their promised government jobs, this doesn't augur for a very, amicable future vis-a-vis the Shia-dominated government and the Sunnis.
Let's get a listener perspective on this point. Michael is on the line from Boston. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My concern is our strategy in Iraq and pulling back to forward operating out bases outside of the city. That was our strategy in 2005. The major difference seems to be that we just hope Iraqi forces can hold the cities and prevent sectarian violence. But my question is, you know, what if they can't? I certainly hope they succeed, but if they fail, are we Americans prepared to charge back in? Do we have the political willpower? And do we even have the manpower to surge in Iraq and Afghanistan at the same time?
Mm-hmm. Michael, thanks. Steve Chapman? Your response?
Well, we've been in Iraq 6 years. The surge started 2.5 years ago. It's only now that American forces are going to drop below what they were pre-surge. You know, we have certainly done more than anybody could have expected in the way of preparing Iraq for the transition. And I think at some point we're going to have to say, it's your country, and it's either going to work or it's not, but it's up to you. It's not up to us. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we're likely to go back in and force and you know, revert to what we were doing before if things start to go bad. I think we're going to have to say, you know, Iraqis are going to have to figure out how to deal with that.
Jibby Martinez, the caller mentioned the surge in Afghanistan. We heard this week 4,000 U.S. Marines backed by helicopter gunships pushed their way into the Helmand River Valley in southwestern Afghanistan. They've reported apparently little resistance from Taliban fighters, but this is one of the deadliest provinces in Afghanistan. What do you make of this new movement, this new surge?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, we are calling it a surge because that's what it is. And in fact, it's very similar to what happened in Iraq under the Bush administration. I think that, you know, they have a big, big problem there trying to convince the people that they are there to help them, that they're not the United States is not the enemy, while at the same time trying to get control of the country. And what makes this so difficult, I think, for the United States is the recent history in Iraq. You know, Iraq, to me, sort of became like, you know, stepping on a piece of old gum and not being able to get it off your shoe. And I think that the administration is cognizant of wanting to get in, establish control in Afghanistan, and help them to, you know, get reestablish their sound footing there, but not get so mired that you can't take it off your shoe, mm-hmm. for lack of a better mm-hmm. metaphor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's going to be really difficult. I mean, I think that the Obama administration, you know, is going to continue sending troops there until they think that, you know, the Afghan security forces have been trained sufficiently enough and can take over control of the population.
Jibby, you make reference in part to the hearts and minds of the Afghan people in your earlier remarks. I'm looking at a headline in the New York Times today, U.S. faces resentment in Afghan regions. It says the mood of the Afghan people has tipped into a, quote, popular revolt in some parts of southern Afghanistan. Villagers have taken up arms against foreign troops to protect their homes, or in anger after losing relatives in airstrikes. This seems to present American forces with a harder problem or a harder job than even originally anticipated, Jack.
Right. And as I said, that's exactly the point. You know, they need to be able to show the Afghan people that the U.S. is not the enemy, while at the same time, the U.S. is trying to take over regions from the Taliban fighters that, you know, are controlling the, you know, poppy harvests and mm-hmm. the opium, you know, smuggling operations and all of that. So, you know, and that's what drives part of the economy there. So, I think Afghanistan, and also because it's been largely ignored for so long and was under the shadow of Iraq, is going to be perhaps even more difficult than we've heard the administration admit to up to this point.
Jack Beatty. Steve Chapman, go ahead.
If winning hearts and minds is the key, you really have to wonder if we figured out how to do that. When you look at the celebrations in Iraq this week about our pulling back, it doesn't look like the Iraqis are just filled with gratitude and affection for the Americans. And it's hard to see how that's going to happen in Afghanistan.
Jack, you see this as a long, protracted effort?
Yeah, imperialism just is not popular among the people who are living under it, or even who are its beneficiaries. And when you think about it, a part of what we're doing in this province is trying to secure things ahead of the August elections. Well, what are the August elections going to produce? They're going to give us a very unsatisfactory leader in President Karzai. We're going to have him again. And the administration doesn't want him, but that's what's going to happen. So that seems to be the best out, you know, if that's what the logic of this is, let's have an election and it just produces the same mediocre and possibly corrupt president, certainly his family is, it's hard to see a good outlook there.
Let's go another call now in Denver, Colorado. Kevin has been waiting. Kevin, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Hi, James.
Hi.
How you doing?
Well, go ahead.
Just my original comment was going to be on Iraq, but it seems the discussion has shifted over to Afghanistan. As someone who has actually been involved in this conflict and served in the military, to address the last caller's issue of not winning the hearts and minds of the people, that has been the sole focus of the military, to engage in these mid-teams and PRT teams, to actually go out and engage the population and allow them to see what America is capable of, to bring to them, and to allow them to start to advance and bring in infrastructure. So I definitely think that the United States has done a very good job on that front. And I think that a lot of people just aren't able to see that kind of thing. And I think that we as a people in the United States need to really start paying attention to what our military is doing on that aspect.
Kevin, thank you. And thanks for your service. Steve Chapman, there he is on the front lines. Kevin, he has a totally different perspective.
I don't fault the American military. I think they've done as good a job as anybody could have done under the circumstances. But the fact is that there's still a lot of resentment of the U.S. as an occupying force. You know, there is no country on earth where you can introduce 150,000 foreign troops and the locals are going to be thrilled about it. And, I mean, I think we've certainly done our best to improve the lives of Iraqis. The American military has certainly done its best. But I think at the end of the day, the Iraqis, you know, they don't like having foreign troops there, and that's why you saw the celebrations going on this week, and I obviously the Afghans have problems with it as well. And I think there's only so much that the skill and sort of sensitivity of the American military can do to mitigate that.
Hmm. Well, let's open the phones here. In Charleston, South Carolina, Phyllis is on the line. Phyllis, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks. Mm-hmm. My point about Sanford is the disappointment I feel in him. I've lived here for 9 years, and in a state where the education motto is thank God for Mississippi, we've got a guy who's turning down money that can help schools. And then the big way he makes news is through this little puppy dog love situation he's got going on. You know, he reminds me of a 17-year-old boy who's in love for the first time, or maybe worse yet, a 17-year-old girl who needs to write this in her diary. And I think it's really unfortunate that he's using this platform to give an image of South Carolina, which needs help with its image to begin with. Mm. And I don't think he's doing us any service.
Phyllis, thank you very much for your call. Jibby Martinez, are the governor's days numbered in South Carolina?
It seems to be so with each interview that he gives. I don't know if he's going to be doing any more interviews, but every time he did, he got himself in a worse situation. What I also think is interesting is that, you know, the comments of his wife that she is willing to forgive him, but she's not helping him in any way reconnect with the voters in South Carolina. And so she's kind of broken the mold on how political wives handle these things. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound like he can last, especially when you have a majority of the Republicans in the state Senate calling for his resignation now. It's and frankly, it doesn't sound like he is as committed to his job anymore as he used to be compared to the relationship that he wants to continue.
There's great interest on this topic on the phones here. So back to Sarah. She's in Columbia, South Carolina. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jane. Uh-huh. Hey, I kind of had a comment about Jenny Sanford as well. I was reading in the newspaper this morning Maureen O'Dowd's column, very critical of Jenny Sanford, who didn't bring any of this on herself, and is handling it pretty well, I think, compared to many of the other political lives in crises. So I had a real problem with the nation and the New York Times being critical of Jenny Sanford. And
Sarah,
I thought that was a good point.
Sarah, thank you very much for calling. Steve Chapman?
Well, looking at it from Chicago, where we have some, you know, experience with having governors as national jokes, I could say, I don't know if Mark Sanford has any political future, but Jenny Sanford might.
She did say this week that her husband's affair with the Argentine woman was, quote, inexcusable. She also said that she was willing to forgive him, and she made her public comment in an email earlier this week that his mistress, in fact, was his soulmate, but that he is trying to fall back in love with his wife. So obviously, this
mighty
goes back and forth.
Him.
Yeah, yeah. Moving on. Hey, Jack, I want to squeeze in here something I know you wanted to talk about. A totally different issue. This week was the 40th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, when gays and lesbians demonstrated against a police raid of a gay club in New York City. It was an event viewed by many as the beginning of the gay rights movement. And on Monday, President Obama spoke with gay leaders at the White House. And some have said the president's not doing enough for gay rights, and here he is acknowledging their concerns.
It's not for me to tell you to be patient any more than it was for others to counsel patience to African Americans who were petitioning for equal rights a half century ago.
Jack Beatty, your thoughts on the significance of this anniversary?
Well, you know, since Don't Ask, Don't Tell, about 12,000 people have been discharged from the armed forces. That's just about the size of a division. And they continue to go. I think there have been 20 or so have gone since Obama has been president. The New Republic made a very good point about this. They pointed out 70% of the public wants Don't Ask, Don't Tell to go away. And if you know, if you put that number in perspective, that's 25 points higher than those who are for Obama's health care plan. But he's fighting very hard for his health care plan. And it's way more than the number who approve of his Afghanistan policy. He's fighting very hard for that. Nevertheless, Don't Ask, Don't Tell still stands. And some people think it could be got rid of administratively, that he could, or that he could order a hiatus on the plan until Congress could act. But it's very clear here that that he has not met the expectations he raised in the campaign. Now, he told the group of activists at the White House, judge us not by the promises we've made, but by the promises we keep. Well, the clock is running on those promises so far as don't ask, don't tell goes.
One last topic to squeeze in here before the end of the hour, Honduras. Jimmy Martinez, the man who replaced President Manuel Zelaya in a coup, said Thursday that he'd be willing to hold elections ahead of schedule, that if that would ease the standoff. Your thoughts on what's going on down there?
I don't think anyone really knows yet how this is going to be resolved, but it doesn't look like it's going to be done quickly. The Organization of American States had given the new leader 72 hours to allow the former president to come back in, and you know, with the promise that the former president would not run for re-election as a sort of a compromise. But the Honduran, the new Honduran government isn't sounding like they're in the mood for compromise. And if they move up the election, that would be the only thing that they would do, it seems. So it is really confusing and very difficult. And it puts the United States in a very tough spot because they've, you know, been such a prominent player in Honduran policy for so many years. So they've got to, you know, I think the Obama administration also still has to figure out its strategy.
Well, great panel. Really interesting week. Many thanks to all of you. Jibby Martinez with Politico. Thanks so much for your time, Jibby.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Steve Chapman with the Chicago Tribune. Thanks, as always, to you, Steve. Great to hear from
you. Great to be with you.
And Jack Beatty. Thanks to you, Jack.
Thank you, Jane.
Have a great weekend, holiday weekend, everybody. You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Nice to be with you this week. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.